Praxeology and Understanding, an analysis of the controversy in Austrian economics, by George Selgin. Prerequisites for successful action. The concepts of monetary surplus and loss are based on economic calculation using market prices. Such calculation is possible only in an order characterized by exchange, the social division of labor, and private ownership of the means of production. With the aid of monetary calculation, entrepreneurial profit and loss, the stimuli that determine the direction of equilibrative adjustments, become social phenomena, distinct from the ex post categories of psychic profit and loss. Calculation makes possible a link between equilibrating action and entrepreneur satisfaction of the wants of others. It allows entrepreneurs to perceive the wants of others as if they were the means toward fulfillment of their own ends. Monetary surplus represents a reward to enterprise for the successful satisfaction of consumers. But this ex post surplus is not itself to be confused with the ex ante concept of entrepreneurial profit. It is a confirmation of the fact that entrepreneurs' imagination and understanding of means and end, including their own, possibly unique, capabilities, were not based upon illusion or incorrect anticipation of the future. Entrepreneurial profits exist, as it were, only at the margin of action, not before or after. The crucial point is that monetary calculation provides essential guidance for entrepreneurial understanding and action. In the absence of such calculation, the imagination of profit opportunities, i.e., entrepreneurial speculation, would indeed become an entirely haphazard process, bearing no meaningful relationship to the state of consumer preferences. Monetary calculation is the guiding star of action. Man calculates in order to distinguish the remunerative lines of production from the unprofitable ones, those of which the sovereign consumers are likely to approve from those which they are likely to disapprove. Without monetary calculation, entrepreneurs would lose vital evidence with which to form their conjectures, and would not even be able to judge whether their previous conjectures were accurate or not. They therefore would be without means for informed direction of their future actions. It is only when market prices exist that calculation, the meaningful ascertainment of profit or loss, success or failure, is possible. In particular, the entrepreneurial function of subjectively distinguishing profit from rents and other factor returns is not conceivable without market prices. The different sources of income can be separated only by referring to these incomes as determined by prices on the market. Only in this way can an entrepreneur estimate implicit opportunity costs and thereby determine that, for example, he is suffering a loss in his business. Then, if the loss continues, he will be impelled to shift his various resources to other lines of production. It is only by means of such estimates that an owner of more than one type of factor can determine his gains or losses in any situation, and then allocate his resources to strive for the greatest gains. The existence of market prices, which itself depends upon private ownership and exchange of the means of production, is therefore a necessary prerequisite to economic calculation. This is the fundamental conclusion of the praxeological critique of socialism. The necessity, not sufficiency, of market prices for entrepreneurial success, including entrepreneurial calculation and understanding, can be ascertained without appeal to other necessary assumptions regarding the use and dissemination of knowledge. Its truth does not depend on the alertness of entrepreneurs in the unhampered market. It derives from consideration of the pure logic of the equilibrium process. In the context of market prices, this process might promote coordination. Otherwise, an essential ingredient is lacking, for which there are no promising substitutes. Many other important practical conclusions of praxeology are based upon the insight that interference with market prices may disrupt enterprise and competition. Such interference acts to lessen the potential for successful entrepreneurial adjustments in the affected markets. Every act of free exchange provides clues to the preferences and indirectly the ends of actors engaged in the exchange. Market prices convey information reflecting understanding derived through a continuing process of such exchanges. Such prices are essential instruments by which entrepreneurs, employing Verstehen or common sense, attempt to form judgments of consumer desires using past preferences as evidence. By the same token, interference with market prices may also corrupt entrepreneurial understanding, causing the disappointment of expectations and fostering discoordination. Any non-market price, a price fixed by fiat rather than through voluntary exchange, confronts numerous entrepreneurs not with potentially useful information, but with a lie. It presents to them a facade of preferences and priorities, which in fact have no basis in the valuations of market participants. Consumer uneasiness may even be aggravated by entrepreneurial actions guided by non-market prices. Hence, the praxeological concern with this type of government intervention. Praxeology does not attribute the failure of socialism to its inability to achieve the conditions of static equilibrium. On the contrary, socialism cannot succeed, according to praxeology, because entrepreneurial action, which includes also the speculative decisions of central planners, cannot succeed without the aid of market prices. Moreover, praxeology sees interference with or absence of competitive market prices as a key to explanation of the failure of many particular market processes. For example, the trade cycle is explained as phenomena initiated by disruption of rates of interest from their natural levels, i.e., the levels that reflect consumer time preference and that would prevail under a system where banks, including central banks, functioned purely as intermediaries of voluntary savings. An artificially lowered rate of interest and accompanying expansion of credit necessarily leads to the distortion of a wide range of other market prices by provoking overestimation of the real supply of loanable funds. The necessary consequences that arise from this include widespread alteration of profit and loss signals and a greater channeling of entrepreneurial activity into undertakings that eventually prove unsustainable. In its references to the effects of intervention, praxeology naturally engages in conjectural history. Nevertheless, whenever the described intervention is present, all of the consequences that praxeology attributes to it will follow. It is the task of history proper to determine whether any actual event corresponds to a certain hypothetical counterpart examined by praxeology. This matter of historical identification is, contra Hayek, the only question of fact to which praxeological conclusions, including ones that, as we have seen, are relevant to catalactics, need to defer. There is no question here of any need for or possibility of verification or falsification of praxeological theories, either in the manner suggested by positivists or by appeal to common sense. We have still to deal with the implication, present for instance in Hayek's essay, that the results of praxeology, although varied and profound, are nevertheless tautological and therefore of no independent practical significance. Here, It may simply be answered that if in fact praxeological results are tautologies, then they are tautologies of great importance. In a sense, they resemble tautologous statements of the sort 2 plus 2 does not equal 5. The statement, one might claim, provides no fresh knowledge of the real world. Nevertheless, it is essential to insist upon its truth whenever anyone is bold enough to deny it. Similarly, the conclusions of praxeology would perhaps be of little value were there not people anxious to defy them. For example, by seeking to avoid the harmful consequences of inflation by means of price controls, by throwing obstacles in the way of rivalrous competition and entrepreneurial innovation, or by advocating socialism as a means for the rational allocation of resources. The demonstration of the inappropriateness of such programs is the prime contribution of praxeological economic theory to human welfare. It is a contribution of more than merely verbal significance. Thus far, we have seen that many praxeological conclusions relevant to catalactics do not depend upon assumptions about knowledge, alertness, and entrepreneurial understanding. They deal with people as such and do not require appeal to common sense or empirical assumptions. We have also seen that, although logically necessary, conclusions derived by praxeology are not intrinsically empty or without practical importance. However, a complete answer respecting this last point cannot be given until the issue of coordination is addressed. We have not yet entirely escaped the claim that praxeology may, after all, be useless. The common sense of coordination. As used in this article, coordination and equilibration are not synonyms. Coordination, which depends upon the correctness of entrepreneurial expectations, is not a praxeological concept. While we cannot think of free action as non-equilibrating, we can conceive of actions that are non-coordinating. In order to establish whether a particular concrete state of affairs exemplifies coordination or the compatibility of plans, social scientists must resort to the common sense method of specific understanding employed in historical analysis. They must therefore abandon the strict subjectivism of praxeology and allow themselves to impute specific ends and aspirations to individuals. Then, in order to determine whether the actions of individuals are compatible with one another, they contrast them with an ideal typical plan of their own construction. In other words, they treat the actions of other individuals as means and judge their efficacy with regard to a set of imputed ends. To maintain that individual plans can be coordinated is to affirm the existence of social causation. The idea that such causation operates is related to the belief that social actions are or may be largely successful. Praxeology conceives of a sequence of social events as coordinated insofar as they result mainly in psychic profit rather than psychic loss. The notion of coordination thus becomes a corollary to the praxeological construct of the progressing economy. But to say that progress actually exists requires an appeal to understanding. Whenever economic history ventures to classify economic evolution within a certain period according to the scheme stationary, progressing, or retrogressing, it resorts, in fact, to historical understanding, verstehen, and does not measure it. There can thus be no question of an answer to the question of coordination in any sense admitting to either apodictic certainty or to empirical falsifiability. Psychic profit and loss are subjective, immeasurable phenomena. A progressing economy requires, first of all, that entrepreneurs are neither so dull nor so content as to never imagine opportunities for profit at all. Otherwise, there would be no innovation or accumulation, and society would settle into the praxeological fiction of the evenly rotating economy. In such a situation, coordination is complete in the sense that there is equilibrium, but it is obviously not coordination in the sense of compatibility of plans, for the evenly rotating economy presupposes the absence of true plans aimed at the elimination of felt uneasiness. It involves, in place of changing plans, the cyclical mechanical motions of lifeless automatons. Ignoring the extreme case of the evenly rotating economy, coordination requires also that there be adequate entrepreneurial foresight, an ability to anticipate future change and thereby to avoid psychic disappointment. Here is where expectations enter into the analysis. It is also where the doctrines of Shackle and Lachmann assert themselves concerning the kaleidic character of the future. In a world in which the future is truly kaleidic, coordination and its counterpart, economic progress, are not possible. Action in such a world, even in the unhampered market, leads not to spontaneous order, but to chaos. Speculation becomes a matter of sheer guesswork, useless and counterproductive. And this will be the case even where there is a freely functioning price system. Under such conditions, action cannot truly be said to be purposeful at all, for actors' belief that they are able to achieve their purposes can only be an illusion. Praxeology would in this case be a body of tautologous assertions of academic interest only. Thus, for example, although the existence of market prices is necessary for coordination because it provides the only reliable means for people's actions to be guided by the wants of others, it may not be sufficient. It could be that anticipations are generally disappointed, so that wealth does not accumulate. Coordination and its representative, economic progress, will then be impossible, even with an unhampered price system. Such possibilities form the crux of the Shackleian challenge to praxeology. On the face of things, it is easy to sympathize with Kirzner's desire to dismiss the divergent expectations or kaleidic future hypothesis. Paris, Kirzner observes, gets fed. This seems to be an appropriate empirical answer to what is in essence an empirical assertion. It might easily be supplemented by a litany of trite observations regarding the accumulation of capital, general improvement of well-being, remarkable scientific and technical achievements, etc., that have been sponsored by the capitalist system. Such a response is also inviting because it suggests that praxeology is not, after all, at loggerheads with historical understanding, that in general, markets do generate order, whereas interference tends to have the destructive effects that praxeology predicts. Nevertheless, the response, based as it is upon appeal to common sense, is always vulnerable to rejection. Those who understand by order and progress something other than what Kirzner has in mind when he refers to the arrival of food at Paris may freely disagree with him. In so doing, they do not, of course, deny the praxeological notion of equilibration. They merely claim that this notion and the central role it assigns to the existence of market prices evade the fundamental issues. In short, praxeology, having broken away from the fully informed schema of neoclassical economics, finds its conclusions challenged by alternative views of precisely the opposite extreme. Its new opponents claim the future to be marked by complete radical uncertainty, a kaleidic future in which action is futile and purposefulness is merely an illusion. If, in fact, this view of reality is correct, then the theories of praxeology are, to repeat Hayek's words, merely formal and tautological. They cannot then tell us anything of practical value, for they are based upon inferences drawn from a faulty premise, namely, that qualitative regularity and causality exist in the sequence of social events. The truth, it is suggested, is just the opposite. The future is unknowable. There is no link between it and the past. Expectations are bound, as often as not, to diverge, and therefore to be disappointed. Choice, whether informed by market price signals or not, can only be haphazard under these conditions. Action may make life more and more chaotic. It generates, at best, merely a stationary economy, one with efforts at improvement continually frustrated, and certainly not a progressing economy. It would be just as well if people did not act, i.e., adjust their plans at all. Implications of the Kalaitic Society. Exponents of the doctrine of the Kalaitic Society have suggested that the praxeological method presupposes a thesis of historical determinism. They believe that in implicitly rejecting their view, praxeology assumes a rigid link between the patterns of people's actions in the present and their patterns in the future. Such an assumption contradicts the Austrian notion of purposefulness and involves, as well, a tacit denial of free will. This representation of praxeology is based upon a serious confusion of its tenets with those of general equilibrium analysis. Moreover, it reveals a failure to appreciate the distinction recognized by praxeology between fatalist determinism and activist determinism. The doctrine of fatalist determinism maintains that the course of social events is beyond human control. Its thesis, to the extent that it is accepted, paralyzes the will and engenders passivity and lethargy among the human species. There is no place in this doctrine for purposeful action. Activist determinism refers to the insight that every change is the result of a cause and that there is regularity in the concatenation of cause and effect. It is distinct from fatalist determinism, and therefore from materialism and what Karl Popper refers to the nightmare of physical determinism, because it allows for the category of mental or social causation. People's actions, according to the thesis of activist determinism, are determined by the ideas, ends, knowledge, and understanding they hold, but praxeology treats these ideas as ultimate data. It does not seek to explain them by tracing them back to prior causes. This is how praxeology separates itself from psychology. What the current critics of praxeology assert is this: if there is no regularity or uniformity in human ideas, if the future is marked by kaleidic change, then people cannot anticipate the actions and requirements of their fellows. Speculation, therefore, becomes haphazard. Action within society, since it necessarily involves speculation about other people's reactions, although it is believed to be purposeful, is vain. Even routine actions presuppose routine behavior on the part of others. All life in society is thus a random, irrational struggle. This thesis amounts to a denial of mental or social causation or of activist determinism. Praxeology cannot prove this denial to be unfounded. It treats the existence of causality, including social causality, as an ultimate given, a priori even, of human purposefulness. The philosophical, epistemological, and metaphysical problems of causality and of imperfect induction are beyond the scope of praxeology. We must simply establish the fact that in order to act, men must know the causal relationship between events, processes, or states of affairs, and only so far as he knows this relationship can his action attain the ends sought. We are fully aware that in asserting this we are moving in a circle, for the evidence that we have correctly perceived a causal relation is provided only by the fact that action guided by this knowledge results in the expected outcome. The questions of coordination and the possibility of progress are one and the same, and both have to do with the existence of social causation. The doctrine that the future is kaleidic, if it means anything at all, means the denial of spontaneous order, coordination, progress, and fundamentally social causation. for the first of these are merely manifestations of the last. No evidence can dispose of the suggestion that the future is collidic and that social causation is lacking. Yet current efforts of Austrian economists include attempts to develop a theory of entrepreneurial prediction, or understanding, that might resolve the problems implied by the uncertainty of the future. This seems to be a part of the intent of Rizzo and O'Driscoll in their book The Economics of Time and Ignorance. Such work may uncover useful evidence concerning conditions that encourage entrepreneurial success. Nevertheless, it is not likely to satisfy critics who maintain that the future is beyond the grasp of entrepreneurial ability. Any efforts of this new Austrian research program to reconstruct praxeology on the basis of a theory of knowledge would in this sense be misguided. The problem is that any explanation of entrepreneurial prediction and understanding must make reference to ideal typical representations of human thought, patterns and preferences, as are employed, for example, in Schutze's work. Such representations already presuppose the regularity and uniformity rejected by those who hold the future to be collidic. If an ideal type refers to people, it implies that in some respect these men are valuing and acting in a uniform or similar way. When it refers to institutions, it implies that these institutions are products of uniform or similar ways of acting and valuing, or that they influence valuing and acting in a uniform or similar manner. Those who consistently believe Shackle's doctrines are bound to view explanations of human understanding that employ ideal-type constructs as unjustified and question-begging. The only other recourse open to those who seek an empirical or falsifiable refutation of Shackle's thesis is to attempt an explanation of social causation itself, that is, an explanation of how a person's actions may bring about a particular set of responses on the part of other people. To pursue such a course of study would require one to entertain a belief in strict behaviorism. Attempts to develop a theory of social causation would degenerate into search for social responses to entrepreneurial stimuli. Were such attempts able to succeed, they could at best provide a basis for a theory not of people's actions but of their reactions, and would therefore encompass a denial of purposefulness. Any such research program must ultimately collapse under the weight of its own self-contradictory presuppositions. But to the extent that it is seriously undertaken by Austrian economists, it would as thoroughly undermine their school's viewpoints as would wholesale adoption of Shackle's views. Although evidence cannot refute the hypothesis that the future is collidic, reason can expose the contradictions that must result from its consistent embrace. Praxeology has employed this approach in the past, in criticizing the doctrines of historicism and logical positivism. The idea that social change is collidic implies, as has been shown, the denial of both fatalist and activist determinism. This leaves only the alternative of complete indeterminism. The social events of the future have no necessary connection with those of the past. In such a world, people would have no reason to act. They would have no reason to believe that any particular action, insofar as its success depends upon the valuations of other people, would lead to any particular desired state of affairs. They could therefore have no basis for preferring one set of actions to another. Such a situation would constitute no less a nightmare than Popper's physical determinism. It would, as its proponents suggest, demolish the categories of order and coordination. But it would also render meaningless the idea of free will. Human will, in order to be useful, must be able to gain some degree of command over its circumstances. Consistently applied, the doctrine of the collidic society must also lead to the abandonment of all quests for knowledge about human action. In the world that it postulates, both theory and history would be useless. People could learn nothing from the past. Moreover, its meaningful investigation would be impossible. If that which is becoming were altogether independent of the past and in no way related to it, not only would historic events have no connection with each other, but we should not have any extended events at all. We cannot speak of any historic process unless there is continuity, unless there are elements of identity between the present and the past. Moreover, To deny that the past molds the future is to deny that there is any continuity or any process. Thus, the search for theory, i.e., for necessary and universal patterns in human action, would be fruitless. Oscar Morgenstern has argued that the assumption of radical uncertainty is incompatible with the pursuit of theoretical knowledge. Next to the assumption of complete unlimited foresight, there must be rejected, too, the assumption that there exists no foresight at all. That would mean complete chaos in the conduct of men. Such an assumption would make the existence of the economy just as impossible as that of economic theory, which, as does all science, has to posit a minimum of uniformity in the world. That there is no kind of foresight would be the equivalent to the assertion that acts of the individuals could not be arranged at all. So it can be maintained that some positive degree of knowledge as to future behavior, that is, one with more or less established assumptions about the future, is absolutely necessary for the economy. All theory presupposes the existence of a degree of qualitative regularity and uniformity in the concrete phenomena of reality. The classification of events and institutions presupposes such a belief. So indeed does the very existence and use of language. Thus, it is utterly contradictory for upholders of the doctrine that the future is collidic to involve themselves in theoretical discussions, especially when such discussions refer to institutions such as banks or money, or to classes of events such as the trade cycle or inflation. Such categories, including all ideal typical constructs employed in economic history and in the hypotheses of social science, have meaning only by virtue of an appeal to the regularity and continuity of events in the social world. Thus, it is futile to attempt, pace Hayek, to explain why people should ever be right. Rather, acceptance of the fact that people can be right is a requirement imposed by the rules of reason themselves. Given this a priori fact, we may proceed directly to consider why people commit mistakes, without troubling ourselves with attempts to investigate the actual mechanisms of social causation. Of course, in making these points, I do not pretend to refute the position of an extreme nihilist who would completely deny a place for causality in the sequence of social events. I merely observe that to be consistent, such a person would have to refrain from making assertions regarding the value and significance of particular market arrangements. More fundamentally, people who wish to deny that there is causation in the social world need to explain their own participation in the market and in the discussions of economic theory. The logical alternative for believers in collidic change who seek to engage in economics is to adopt a tempered version of the collidic society thesis. In this case, they might maintain that the future is only potentially collidic, and that history does witness temporary periods of relative stability and even progress. In the midst of such intervals, institutions exist that possess a degree of permanence. Economic theory may deal with these institutions and with the human actions that give rise to them, although it must recognize that its conclusions are never a description of necessary or universally valid truths. This outlook, of course, defines historicism. There is no point in repeating here the familiar epistemological arguments that oppose it. To summarize, praxeology cannot refute historicism or any other variant of the thesis that the future is unconnected with the past. It treats the category of causality, including mental and social causality, as a priori. It assumes a world marked neither by perfect certainty nor by collidic change and continually diverging expectations. In other words, it takes as given a set of conditions that make purposeful human action possible, and it then asks what circumstances hamper and which ones assist the likelihood of agents' success. In proceeding in this manner, instead of seeking to actually explain why men should ever be right, praxeology takes the only route available to theory that avoids self-contradiction. It adopts as its starting point, but does not try to explain, the actual persistence of human habits and institutions. That is one of the great facts of theory, which we cannot ignore if we are to retain any understanding. A stalwart might still argue that praxeology, like Euclidean geometry, is purely formal and arbitrary rather than necessarily true. On this view, praxeology may not apply to any actual experience of social reality, but expressing the argument in this manner immediately reveals its absurdity, for to imagine a social experience to which the logic of action does not apply is to imagine away social experience altogether. This is because the idea of experience itself presupposes the categories of causality and regularity on which praxeology depends. In a universe lacking regularity, there could not be any thinking and nothing could be experienced. For experience is the awareness of identity in what is perceived. It is the first step toward a classification of events, and the concept of classes would be empty and useless if there were no regularity. So long as there can be meaningful experience of social phenomena, then this experience will be one for which the deductions of praxeology are valid. To imagine otherwise is to imagine a social environment free from meaningful experience altogether. Thinking and acting people cannot consistently regard their world as one in which the laws of praxeology are mere formalities. Of course, it may be that a world exists in which praxeology would not provide useful knowledge, but this would not be a world in which either purposeful action or economic knowledge mattered or would be possible. The observations of any non-praxeological economics, even if valid, could not serve any useful purpose. Furthermore, theories of knowledge dissemination and of the market process, however informative they may be, can no more replace praxeology than they can undermine the doctrine of the radically collided society, nor should they be viewed as prerequisites to the drawing of valid praxeological conclusions.